Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 through 27. I am going to do the entire chapter. We'll call it Moab Rebels Against Israel. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 2 of 2 Kings, we see Elijah taken to heaven in a whirlwind in a chariot of fire. So we start now at 2 Kings 3, verses 1 through 3. Joram, he ruled from 852 to 841 B.C., son of Ahab, who ruled before him at 874 to 853 B.C., Joram became king over Israel and Samaria during the 18th year of Judah's king Jehoshaphat, who ruled from 870 to 848. Joram reigned 12 years. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight, but not like his father and mother. His father was Ahab and his mother Jezebel. For Joram removed the sacred pillar of Baal his father Ahab had made. Nevertheless, Joram clung to the sins that Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had caused Israel to commit. He did not turn away from them. Now, Joram, in verse 2, is said to do what was evil in the Lord's sight. Well, every last one of the northern kings of Israel were said to do what was evil in the Lord's sight, so there's nothing new there. However, there's an interesting wrinkle on his evil reign. He removed the sacred pillar of Baal his father had made. That's some Baal statue that was put in some Baal temple somewhere that Ahab had introduced. Remember, Ahab was the first king to introduce Baal worship. Jeroboam, who started the northern king of Israel in 931 B.C., he introduced golden calf worship of Yahweh, not a pagan god, but the true Yahweh. In other words, the golden calf worship was worship of the correct god with the incorrect manner. Now, Joram didn't destroy, is not said to destroy the sacred pillar of Baal. He just removed it from the temple of Baal so that it might not be publicly worshipped. Well, that's arguing from silence. Maybe he did destroy it, maybe he didn't. What were his motivations in dissing this statue of Baal? Maybe his conscience got to him. Or maybe he was just afraid because he had seen his father Ahab and his brother Ahaziah die early. Ahab, remember, got shot by a random arrow in the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. That ended his life. And then Ahaziah fell through a lattice in Samaria. They were Baal worshippers. And maybe Joram is thinking, well, Baal didn't do my father and brother too good. Maybe I better just get him out of the way. It could be for political reasons, some people have speculated. As we'll see in the rest of this chapter, Joram is going to enlist Jehoshaphat as an ally in a war against Moab, and Jehoshaphat is not going to like Baal worship because he was a true Yahweh worshiper. He was a good king. And Jehoshaphat might not want to come up and worship or ally himself with a Baal worshiper. Well, Jehoshaphat did it anyway. He had already done it. As a matter of fact, he did it with Ahab. He was allied with Ahab in the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead, and Ahab was a true Baal worshiper, so Jehoshaphat wasn't too worried about the company he kept, and so I'm not sure that Joram was really concerned about that when he got rid of Baal, the Baal statue. He might have figured, well, Jehoshaphat's going to join with me anyway, whether I worship Baal or not, or maybe he thought that was just one more factor that Jehoshaphat might consider. We don't know, but at any rate, he was a bad king, but he wasn't bad as Ahab and his mother Jezebel. His sins, as we read in verse 3, that he clung to were the sins that Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had caused Israel to commit. And of course, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, is the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel. He ruled from 931 B.C. to 910 B.C. And of course, he's famous for setting up the golden calves in Dan in the north and Bethel in the south. We go now to verses 4 through 8 of 2 Kings 3. King Mesha of Moab was a sheep breeder. He used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Joram marched out from Samaria at that time and mobilized all Israel. Then he sent a message to King Jehoshaphat of Judah. The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? Jehoshaphat said, I will go. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. Then he asked, which route should we take? Joram replied, the route of the wilderness of Edom. Now, Mesha of Moab used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs, 100,000 rams. That would be tribute once a year. That's typical when a country has been beaten by another country. They would pay tribute, as opposed to the conquering country actually taking over the government of the conquered country. So tribute was being paid and then quit. It says that Mesha used to pay. He used to pay the king of Israel. Which king of Israel? Well, he used to pay Ahab. But then when Ahab died, Misha rebelled and quit paying. Well, that could have meant he quit paying in the reign of Ahaziah, Joram's brother, who took over after Ahab. And that's probably when it was. It could have been he rebelled during the reign of Joram. And so that's why Joram is getting ready to fight Misha. It's not really clear, but we'll see that the purpose of this battle is surely economic. You quit paying tribute, well, by golly, you're going to get attacked. That's the way things were done in the ancient Near East. 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. The rams are male sheep. Now, was that a lot? Was that a lot of tribute that Moab had quit paying? The pulpit commentary says Moab had been treated oppressively, had been forced to pay an extraordinarily heavy tribute, and was in a certain sense driven into rebellion. So it was the Israelites' fault, according to the pulpit commentary. On the other hand, Colin Delitzsch takes exactly the opposite approach. They say this, quote, "This yearly tribute could not be exorbitant for the land of the Moabites, which abounded in good pasture and was specially adapted for the rearing of flocks." Well, that shows that nobody really knows whether this was reasonable or not, how much the tribute was. But whether it was reasonable or not, Joram was upset because it wasn't being paid anymore. So he got his troops together, he mobilized them, old-fashioned word, he mustered them. By the way, Joram is, in some translations, called Jehoram, J-E-H-O-R-A-M, with an extra E-H there. For example, the New American Study Bible does that. I don't do that because Joram is the northern king of Israel who's the son of Ahab. And if you just say Joram, you distinguish him from the Jehoram in the south, who we'll take up a little bit later. So it's understandable that King Joram of northern Israel would want to go fight to get his tribute back. But the next question is why would Jehoshaphat want to help him? Well, here's some suggestions. Perhaps he went on this expedition with Joram to encourage Joram in the religious reformation that Jehoshaphat had done in the south. Jehoshaphat, of course, was a good king, got rid of a lot of idol altars, didn't get rid of the Yahweh altars in the high places, but he got rid of a lot of stuff, and so he was a good king, and maybe he's thinking, Joram got rid of the Baal and the Baal temple, wherever that was, in northern Israel, he got rid of that, so he must be a good guy. Well, I want to help him out. I don't believe that, but that's an idea. Another option as to why Jehoshaphat wanted to go on this expedition was that Jehoshaphat wanted to chastise the Moabites for their invasion of Judah, which we read about in 2 Chronicles 21. Now, it came about after this that the sons of Moab and the sons of Ammon, together with some of the Munites, came to make war against Jehoshaphat. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that's why Jehoshaphat wanted to go back and fight against Moab in retaliation for that. Now in verse 8, Joram discusses some strategy with Jehoshaphat and says, which route should we take in order to attack Moab? Jehoshaphat asked that, and Joram replied, the route of the wilderness of Edom. It's capitalized in the Holman Christian Study Bible like it's got a name, but most translations just say, we're going to go through the wilderness of Edom. Now, there were two possible ways for Joram to get to Moab. Moab, remember, is the pagan country that's to the east of the Dead Sea, and it extends from the north somewhere around the top of the Dead Sea. The big city of Heshbon was up there. And you go all the way down, halfway down the Dead Sea to the Arnon River, which flows into the Dead Sea east to west. And then you cross the Arnon River and go even further south to the brook Zered, which runs into the Dead Sea east to west at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. So basically, just think Moab, think west of the Dead, east of the Dead Sea. Now, Joram is, of course, north of the Dead Sea in the northern part of Israel. He can either go straight across the Jordan River and hit Moab coming down from the north going south. That would be the northern route. Or he could go through Israel, allied with Jehoshaphat, and then go through Edom, which is south of Israel, between the Dead and the Red Sea, and then cut across the mountains there south of the Dead Sea, cut across those Edomite mountains, and then hit Moab coming up from the south. So that's the southern route. Now, what are the disadvantages of the southern route, according to Colin Delitzsch? Well, it was longer, a lot further to go, especially for Joram. He had to come all the way up from Samaria. And also, the mountains in the south were very difficult to ascend. Now, the area around the south of the Dead Sea, if you look at a map, if you look at Google Earth, I've actually been in the mountains to the south of the Dead Sea, further south, around Petra, and They are nasty. They are very, very nasty. So that would be a disadvantage of going the southern route. But the southern route is nonetheless the route that they should take, Joram says. Well, what are some of the advantages of the southern route? Well, first of all, it would be a surprise to Moab to see troops coming from the south. They would assume that Joram is going to attack straight over the Jordan in the north of the Dead Sea. The reason Moab would be surprised that an attack would come from the south is that Moab would figure mountains in the south would make that way inaccessible. Now, another advantage of the southern route is that Moab was less defended on the wilderness side down there on the south. The Moabites wouldn't put troops down there because they wouldn't expect anybody to be coming from down there. And also, another advantage, according to Joram, is that northern Israel and Judah, southern Israel, could take the king of Edom along with them as they went down south of Israel, hit the territory of Edom, and then they say, okay, king of Edom, you can come along with us. Now, at that time, Edom was tributary to Judah, and as a tributary, he would be obliged to participate, according to one of my commentators. Kyle and Dillett say that when he participated, the purpose would not be for Edom to strengthen the Hebrew army, but rather to make sure Edom wouldn't invade Israel during the Moabite operation. So that's an advantage for going to the southern route. And also, Kyle and Dillett add that if Joram takes the southern route, he doesn't have to worry about the Syrians at his back at Ramoth-Gilead if he takes the northern route. Ramoth-Gilead is right to the north of Ammon, and would be very close to where Joram would cross the Jordan River, and Ramoth-Gilead was a big place, and the Syrians owned it, and they could get him from the rear. You don't have to worry about that if you go down to the south of the Dead Sea. So, plans having been made, we go now to 2 Kings 3, verses 9 through 12. So the king of Israel went with the king of Judah, the king of Israel being Joram, and the king of Judah is Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom, we don't know his name, and they made a circuit of 7 days' journey. A circuit, that means they're going down around the Dead Sea, and then south of the Dead Sea, and around up to Moab. That's the way they were going. And after 7 days, there was no water for the army or for the cattle that fodded them. They had a big logistics problem here. Verse 10, then the king of Israel said, alas, for the Lord has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab, the three kings being Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of the Lord by him? And one of the king of Israel's servants, that's Joram's, one of Joram's servants answered and said, Elisha the son of Shaphat is here, who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. Now in verse 10, Joram says, Yahweh has called these three kings, Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom, he's called them to let them be beat by the Moabites. Well, that's strange that Joram would say that God was calling the three kings to be defeated. It doesn't show much faith. I think he was pretty depressed by the circumstances. Of course, they all knew that their gods, whatever god they called on, they believed that they controlled circumstances. And so they say, well, we're going to get beat, and God is behind this, so God did it. Yahweh has done us in. Jehoshaphat was not willing to say that, and he said, well, let's ask a prophet of Yahweh. Jehoshaphat is saying, no, we don't want to fall into the hand of Moab. And what does that mean, fall into the hand of Moab? Well, the army would be so weak from thirst that they wouldn't be able to fight, or it could be that the army would have to disperse in order to find water, and being scattered would not be able to fight the enemy. So either way, either from thirst or from being scattered all over the place looking for water, the army's going to get beat. And Jehoshaphat knows that, and so he says, well, wait a minute now, let's ask a prophet of Yahweh here in our bad situation. Now, the pulpit commentary says, you know, it might have been a good idea for Jehoshaphat to consult a prophet before the operation, not when you get yourself in trouble. Oh, here's a good application point here. You want to do something for God, but you do it without praying, or something for yourself or for your family, and you do it without praying, and then you get yourself in trouble, and then you pray. Well, how many times have we done that? In my personal case, about 2 or 3 million. It's not a good idea to do that. Always better to pray before you do something. Public commentary says that in Jehoshaphat's favor, at least he didn't persist in his neglect. He said, well, I'm in trouble now, so let's pray now. Let's get a word from God now. Now, apparently, Joram did not know that Elisha was traveling with the army, because an attendant had to tell him. And that attendant said, Elisha used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. That's strange. What does that mean? Well, it just means that Elisha was Elijah's body servant, used to help him take a bath. Verse 12, Jehoshaphat says, the word of the Lord is with Elisha. Well, how did Jehoshaphat know that? Well, he may have heard of Elisha by reputation. The pulpit commentary says that Jehoshaphat may have heard, and the emphasis on the pulpit commentary there on the may, he may have heard of Elisha's miracles in 2 Kings 2, where Elisha split the Jordan River with Elijah's mantle, his cloak, where Elisha healed the bitter waters of Jericho by putting salt in the water, where Elisha cursed the juvenile delinquents who told him, hey, Baldy, and then Elisha cursed those kids, and two female bears came up and ate 42 of them. Now, Jehoshaphat might have heard of all that, but he also might have just heard when Joram's attendant said that Elisha used to pour water on Elijah's hand. Well, Jehoshaphat knew about Elijah. His reputation, I'm sure, was well established by then, and so he figured, well, if Elisha's working with Elijah, he must be a good prophet. So all the three kings, Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Eden, went down to Elisha. What was Elisha doing there? Well, he might have just decided to follow the troops in order to assist with his advice and counsel. Or, as the pulpit commentary suggests, perhaps Elisha was instigated by the Holy Spirit to go down there. But at any rate, he was down there. Now notice that the three kings didn't send for Elisha. They went down to Elisha. Or, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, they went to Elisha in order to honor him. They're in trouble. So they honor the prophet by humbly going to meet him. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 13 through 14. Now Elisha said to the king of Israel, what do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father, Ahab, and to the prophets of your mother, Jezebel. And the king of Israel, Joram, said to Elisha, no, for the Lord has called these three kings together. That's Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom. The Lord has called these three things together to give them into the hand of Moab. Still pretty depressed, preaching defeat, doom, and gloom. Verse 14, Elisha said, as the Lord of hosts lives. That's an oath. That's a swear. Elisha said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look at you, nor see you. Ooh, that's pretty rude. I love it when prophets speak truth to power. Why was he so rude? Well, because Elisha considered Joram an idolater, one commentator has suggested. But I say, well, yeah, but didn't Joram take down the Baal from the Baal temple? Well, that's true he did, but he still had those golden calves up there. Elisha's not happy with Joram. But he was happy with Jehoshaphat. He says, I regard the presence. I consider the presence of Jehoshaphat. He's a good king, so I'll talk to you because you're alive with Jehoshaphat. Now, when Elisha told Joram to go speak to the Baals and the Astartes, the prophets of the Baal, the prophets of the Asherah, the Astartes, when Elisha told Joram to do that, Joram said, no, I'm not going to do that. Why did he say that? Why did he say, I'm not going to Baal, I'm not going to Astarte? Well, it's because those gods, Baal and Astarte, have nothing to do with Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom. They're not Jehoshaphat's gods. They're not the king of Edom's gods. And those kings are about to go down to defeat as well as me, so why should I go to Baal and Astarte? Baal and Astarte's not going to help them. And I suspect that Joram didn't believe that Baal was going to help him either. After all, he had just put the idol of Baal outside of the Baal temple, which I assume was in Samaria. Joram sounds pretty defeated and depressed here, and he's certainly not relying on Baal and Astarte to get him out of his trouble. So Joram is still sounding pretty defeated and depressed here. He is perhaps hoping that Elisha would show him some mercy, and that's why he says, no, I'm not going to go to Baal and Astarte, because I know you don't like Baal and Astarte, Elisha. I'm looking to you for help. We go down to 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 15. Elisha speaks. He says, but now bring me a minstrel. And it came about when the minstrel played that the hand of the Lord came upon him. Why did he ask for a minstrel or some kind of a musician who could sing? Here's what John Gill says, quote, to allay Elisha's passion and compose his spirits, ruffled at the sight of Jehoram, and to fit him to receive prophetic inspiration, which sometimes came upon the Lord's prophets when thus employed. And Gill quotes 1 Samuel 10:5, which reads this way, afterward you will come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is, and it shall be as soon as you have come there to the city that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and a lyre before them, and they will be prophesying. This This is Samuel speaking to Saul, and this verse, verse 5 in 1 Samuel 10, mentions prophets coming with harp, tambourine, flute, and a lyre. So you see, music is associated with prophecy, which just shows you that music can get you close to God, if it's the right kind of music, of course. It reminds me of what Paul the Apostle says, I will speak in the Spirit and I will sing in the Spirit. That means singing in tongues. It's a lost art. Pentecostals don't do it. Charismatics, too busy chasing money to do it, chasing prosperity to worship in the Spirit. But I was blessed when I was in college to be around some Christian brothers and sisters who believed in that and did it. And I'll tell you, it does get you closer to God. Although I'm sure John MacArthur won't believe that, because he thinks that everything that's speaking in tongues is of the devil, or whatever he believes. But it's true. Music gets you close to God. Verse 16 through 20 of 2 Kings 3. He, that's Elisha, said, thus says the Lord, make this valley full of trenches. For thus says the Lord, you shall not see wind, nor shall you see rain. Yet that valley shall be filled with water, so that you shall drink, both you and your cattle and your beast. This is but a slight thing in the sight of the Lord. He will also give the Moabites into your hand. Then you shall strike every fortified city and every choice city, and fell every good tree, and stop all springs of water, and mar every good piece of land with stones. It happened in the morning about the time of offering the sacrifice that, behold, water came by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. Now I'm going to assume this is after the Israelites had passed the brook Zered. I have no way of knowing that. Zered is the southernmost boundary of Moab, but just to make this easier to think about in our heads, we'll assume that they've crossed that brook. They're in the southern edge of Moab now, and Elisha's telling them, you're going to have water. Don't you worry about it. And not only will you have water, but once you drink, you're going to be whooping up on the Moabites, knocking down their fortified cities, felling their trees, stopping their springs of water, marring their good piece of land with stones. Good things are ahead. Well, I was ought to cheer up the depressed Joram. Why did Elisha tell them to make a valley full of trenches? Well, that's to hold the water when the water comes. And of course, think about the faith that took. They had to spend a lot of effort there. Don't have any water. They're probably half thirsting to death, and now they've got to dig trenches. That takes trust, because well, they were in trouble. What else could they do? The prophet says to dig trenches, so they dig trenches. Now, where did this water come from when the trenches filled up? Well, did it come from the sky? John Gill and Adam Clark said, no, the water did not come from the sky, because verse 17 says, you will not see rain. You will not see wind. Well, of course, they don't see wind, but what he means is you will not see the effects of wind, nor will you see rain. And so Gill and Clark say the water didn't come from the sky. But listen to what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown have come up with. Far from the Israelitish camp in the eastern mountains of Edom, a great fall of rain, a kind of cloudburst, took place, by which the wadi was at once filled, but the Israelites saw neither the wind nor the rains. The divine interposition was shown by introducing the laws of nature to the determined end in the predetermined way, which is a fancy way of saying there was a flash flood at the end of a wadi, one of these dried out desert streams, that once there's a sudden burst of rain, the wadis fill up, the waters come, flash floods come. In fact, you can get killed that way very easily. I remember I was in the desert of Tsin, Z-I-N, Tsin, with my Jewish tour guide, and he pointed out the way he thought Moses had come through the desert. And he said, see the wadis over there? He said, if Moses had been in one of those wadis when a flash flood had come, he said they would all have been drowned, just like they would have drowned at the Red Sea. So he was very impressed with the ability to get caught in the rain. And in fact, if I remember correctly, I think I saw signs there that said, warned you to stay out of those wadis because you could get yourself in trouble if the rain came. And so I think that Jameson, Foster, and Brown have hit upon what happened here. There was a flash flood from a long way off, and the water came down the wadis, and they used the trenches there that were dug intersecting the wadi, and the trenches filled up. Now, it could be, so some other options, that the water came out of some rock from some spring below in the middle of the desert. Adam Clark says that there's nothing providential about this, nothing natural, that there was a completely miraculous appearance of water. I don't believe that. I believe that God always works through providence, natural means, even though the natural means might be unusually applied at the particular time. That's generally the way God works, not always, but generally. So I think Jameson, Foss, and Brown's got the answer there. That's where the water came from. Now, Elisha told the three kings, you shall strike every fortified city and fell every good tree. Well, now, cutting down the trees, wasn't that against the law? Deuteronomy 20, verse 19 says this, when you besiege a city a long time to make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man that it should be besieged by you? It's all right to besiege people, but don't besiege a tree. It's all right to chop a man down by an axe. He's a soldier. That's what soldiers have to put up with. But a tree, he's defenseless. He can't swing an axe back at you. So why are you besieging a tree? Well, if the law said don't cut a tree down and Elisha says do cut a tree down, is Elisha contradicting the law? Little theological problem there. Here's some options to reconcile Elisha's command to cut the tree down with the law in Deuteronomy 20:19. Option number one, Deuteronomy referred to trees belonging to besieged cities only. And Elisha's not talking about besieged cities. He's just talking about trees along the way. Well, the problem with that is, why would you chop down trees along the way? There's no point in it. Firewood? I don't think so. Here's another option to reconcile the two. Option number two, Deuteronomy only referred to Canaanite cities. So you don't tear down the trees of Canaanite cities, but you're in Moab now, and that's not a Canaanite city, so you can chop down a Moabite tree. Well, the problem I have with that is, what's the difference between a Canaanite city and a Moabite city? They were both opposed to Israel. Why would the law make the distinction? Option number three, the law in Deuteronomy was temporarily suspended to the detriment of the Moabites. In other words, God gave Elisha sanction to suspend the law. I'm always a little bit wary of that kind of solution. Option number four, Deuteronomy was concerned with fruit trees, because fruit trees think about 2 or 3 years before they can grow fruit, and if you cut them down, the city's not going to be good for you when you take it over. Deuteronomy's concern with fruit trees says this option, but here in Moab, Elisha was concerned with trees which could be used for fortifications. So chop down those trees so the Moabites can't use the trees to build fortresses against you. I think that's the best option, option number four, difference between a fruit tree and a fortification tree. Elisha also said stop all springs of water so that the Moabites wouldn't have water for their troops, and that's the best way in this environment to knock out a opposing army. And then Elisha says mar the fields with rocks. We're going to see in a couple of verses later that each soldier probably picked up a rock and dropped it in the field. The purpose of that was so the field could not be plowed or sowed. You know, when farmers clear fields, one of the worst things they have to do, the hardest things they have to do, is pick up all the rocks and dig them out, cart them off. As Adam Clark says, if the whole army threw one rock on a good field as they passed, that would do the job. Now, when did the water show up for the Israelites? In the morning, about the time of offering the sacrifice, in verse 20. In the morning. That seems like a incidental detail that's not necessary, but actually, we'll see in just a minute, that detail is important to understand what happens next. That small time detail also gives more credibility to the account. It's going to explain what I call the red optical illusion, the Moabites suffer shortly. The time of the offering of the morning sacrifice, this was of course referring to Jerusalem when the sacrifice was offered. It was usually after the break of day, soon after the break of day. So we go now to 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 21 through 24. Now all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, and all who were able to put on armor and older were summoned and stood on the border. Now it sounds like they were fully mobilized, all who were able to put on armor. That would be young people and people who were older than that. They stood on the border. I'm assuming that's the brook Zered, although none of my commentators said where that was, but Zered is the southern border of Moab, so we'll assume that that's where they were. They, that's the Moabites, rose early in the morning, and the sun shone on the water that had just shown up early in the morning. The Moabites looked at it, and the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. Then they said, this is blood. The kings have surely fought together, and they have slain one another. Now therefore, Moab, to the spoil. Verse 24, but when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites arose and struck the Moabites, so that they fled before them, and they went forward into the land, slaughtering the Moabites. Now, this is a very interesting event here. Why did the Moabites think they were looking at blood instead of at water? Well, the Moabites had no notion that no idea, no notion that there would be water there. There hadn't been any rain for a long time, and of course the postulated thunderstorm that I'm speculating about happened a long way off when the water came down the wadi, and so they're not used to seeing water there. And so when they look down and they see water and the sunshine, the sunlight is coming up and reflecting off the water, that makes the water look red. And they're not thinking water now. They're just thinking this is not supposed to be water down there. Instead, they see something red that looks like liquid is it's flowing, it's moving. Here's what Colin Delitzsch say about this. The illusion, which was so fatal to the Moabites, is also to be explained in the natural manner indicated in the text. From the reddish earth of the freshly dug trenches, the water collected in them had acquired a reddish color, which was considerably intensified by the rays of the rising sun, so that when seen from a distance, it resembled blood. The Moabites, however, were the less likely to entertain the thought of an optical delusion from the fact that with their accurate acquaintance with the country, they knew very well that there was no water in the wadi at that time. They knew it, but they knew it wrongly. So not only the sunlight, but also the red color of the earth. And I've been in that area, and the earth is extremely red. It's reddish brown, of course. It's a dark red, but it's very, very red. And so it would be easy to mistake the water there for blood. And of course, armies a lot of times did end up fighting each other and killing each other by mistake in confusion, getting killed by friendly fire, as we put it in modern terms. The kings have surely fought together, says the Moabites, the three kings, Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom. Now, one of my commentators says that the Moabites might think that this happened from what had lately been done among themselves and their allies. We read in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 23, for the sons of Ammon and Moab rose up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir. And that's the Edomites. Mount Seir is the mountains of Edom. So you got Ammon and Moab allied against Edom. And when they had finished, Ammon and Moab, with the inhabitants of Seir, when they finished killing them, then they helped to destroy one another. Ammon and Moab, they went after each other. So maybe they're thinking this has happened again, except now it's the fratricide is between the northern Israelites of Joram and the southern Israelites, the Judahites of Jehoshaphat, as well as the king of Edom. And verse 24, we see that the Moabites came to the camp of Israel. They weren't marching in military formation. They weren't expecting a battle. They were just coming willy-nilly, higgly-piggly, trying to get spoil. And oops, when they got there, oh my gosh, they got an organized army facing them, and then they are routed. We go down to 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 25 through 27, and we'll be finished with this chapter. They destroyed the cities, that's the three kings, destroyed the cities of Moab, and each of them threw stones to cover every good piece of land. They stopped up every spring of water and cut down every good tree, just like Elisha had told them to do. In the end, only the buildings of Kir-Hareseth were left. Then men with slings surrounded the city and attacked it. When the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took 700 swordsmen with him to try to break through to the king of Edom, but they could not do it. So he took his firstborn son, who was to become king in his place, and offered him as a burnt offering on the city wall. Great wrath was on the Israelites, and they withdrew from him and returned to their land. Now the stones that the Israelite and the Judahite and the Edomite soldiers used to throw on the croplands of the Moabites were probably taken from walls and houses that had been pulled down along the way, or maybe they were just picked up by the road as they passed along. Now they've crossed the brook Zered, and they've gone up east of the mountains there, the mountains that run alongside the eastern shore of the Dead Sea. The King's Highway, as a matter of fact, runs up east of those mountains, heads all the way up, comes all the way from Araba down at the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, from the northern tip of one of the branches or gulfs of the Dead Sea, all the way up through Moab, Ammon, eastern Manasseh, into the Syrian countries, all the way up to Damascus. Well, on this big highway, when we're still here in Moab, right to the east of the southern end of the Dead Sea is Kir-Hareseth. Now, Kir-Hareseth, as Barnes says, is identified almost certainly with the modern Karak, a strong city on the highland immediately east of the southern part of the Dead Sea. It was the great fortress of Moab, though not the capital, It was an important stronghold at the time of the Crusades and is still a place of great strength. So apparently this place is still around. At least it was in the early 1800s. I assume it's still here. The Israelites weren't able to demolish Kir Hareseth. It was a fortified city. The king of Moab and what was left of his forces had holed up in that city. They were besieged. Now the Israelites weren't able to take it down, but they were able to attack it. They took men with slings, surrounded Kir Hareseth, and attacked the city with slings, throwing rocks at the people on the walls, I presume. Or it could be they used siege engines that threw stones against the walls. So it's either the soldiers standing on the walls, as Clark says, or it's siege engines that threw stones against the wall, and they were trying to take it. Now, in the midst of this extremity for the kings of Moab, Misha, the king, took 700 swordsmen with him to try to break through the besiegers to get to the king of Edom, in order to capture or kill the king of Edom, I'm sure. Why did they aim at the Edomites? One commentator says it's because the Edomites remembered how the Edomites had lately used the Moabites, which made them fight more desperately against those Edomites. We read in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 23, "For the sons of Ammon and Moab rose up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir," that's the Edomites, "destroying them completely." So Moab apparently didn't like Edom too much, and so the speculation is they went after the Edomites. But I don't think so. I think they're just trying to escape with their lives, and it just might be that the Edomites were closest by. It could have just been more advantageous militarily to attack Edom rather than Joram or Jehoshaphat. But at any rate, they failed to break through, so they're still stuck in the city. So the Moabites are in deep doo-doo. So Misha took his firstborn son, verse 27, offered him as a burnt offering on the city wall. Burn him up. And here at the end of verse 7 is a phrase that has bothered me ever since I was a little kid. It is a phrase which excites commentators to give diverse opinions all over the place. I looked at about 10 commentators and found about 5 different opinions. So we're going to look at this. Great wrath was on the Israelites, and they withdrew from him and returned to their land. Well, what does this mean? 5 options. Option number 1. Moab was showing great wrath against Israel. So we read it this way. Great wrath from the Moabites was on the Israelites, and so the Israelites went home. The idea here is that Moab's sacrifice of Misha's son showed how desperately opposed to Israel Moab was, and how angry they were against Israel, and so Israel went home. The pulpit commentary to back that up says this, quote, "The terrible act of their king, to which they considered that Israel had driven him, stirred up such a feeling of fury among the residue of the Moabite nation that the Confederates quailed before it and came to the conclusion that they had best give up the siege and retire." In other words, the Moabites are so determined and so nasty and so angry at the Israelites go home. Well, I guess that's reasonable. Let's look at option number 2. It's not the Moabites that are angry with Israel, but it's rather God who is angry with Israel. Adam Clark says God was so angry with Israel. Why? Because the Israelites had driven things to such an extremity that the poor Moabites would actually sacrifice a king's son on the wall. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Elijah had told them to go fight Moab, and they're fighting Moab. Here's what the Cambridge commentator says, quote, "The word rendered wrath or indignation is nearly always used of the wrath of God against offenders, but it appears difficult to take it in that sense here. God's promise through Elisha was that Israel should conquer, and they were bidden to smite every fenced city and every choice city. So why can you say God was angry at Israel for doing what God, through Elisha, had told them to do? And besides that, another reason why I don't think God is angry with Israel, Israel could not have anticipated nor prevented the sacrifice. It just happened. However, Kyle and Delitch, who are a lot smarter than me, disagree with that, and they say this, quote, "This act of abomination, to which the king of the Moabites had been impelled by the extremity of his distress, brought a severe judgment from God upon Israel." See, God's angry with Israel. "The besiegers, that is to say, felt the wrath of God which they had brought upon themselves by occasioning human sacrifice, which is strictly forbidden in the law." They occasioned human sacrifice? They didn't do it. How could they expect that their enemy is going to do something that horrible? But Gallandillet said that they should be blamed for that. And then the wrath of God came upon the Israelites, either inwardly in the Israelites' conscience or in some outwardly visible sign, so that they gave up the further prosecution of the siege and the conquest of the city. So, God is angry with Israel. That's option number 2. I don't believe that. Option number 3. the Israelites were indignant with themselves. They were angry at themselves. That's Barnes's idea. Benson agrees with that, says that the phrase in question should be translated thus: there was great trouble or repentance upon, in, or among Israel. Let me read that again. Instead of saying great wrath was on the Israelites, you would say there was great repentance among the Israelites. Or there was great indignation among the Israelites. That's another translation issue. Is it indignation or is it repentance? Well, I found two commentators. Well, one commentator beside Benson who take that view. Benson says further, quote, they were extremely grieved on account of this barbarous sacrifice, the Israelites were, and wished they had not pushed on a war so far, which ended in such a hard action. In other words, the Israelites were angry with themselves. Cambridge commentator says, quote, there rose indignation that they had been brought to partake in an expedition which led to such a dreadful sacrifice. They were angry that they had gotten involved in this, that things had gotten pushed so far. I really think that's sort of a stretch. We'll look at option number four. This is from Barnes. Judah is angry at Israel and Edom for having caused the pollution of the sacrifice. So we read the phrase in question this way. Great wrath on the part of Judah was on the northern Israelites for having gotten them into this mess and causing a sacrifice on the wall. Of course, you have to take Israelites in the narrow northern Israelite sense and not in the broad sense of the whole 12 tribes. That's one problem with that. I still have trouble believing that. Why are they angry at each other? The prophet Elijah told them to go get them. Well, here's the fifth option, my last option, and I think this is a ludicrous option. This is from Ellicott. The wrath of Chemosh, not the wrath of Yahweh now, the wrath of the Moabite god Chemosh had fallen on the Hebrews and the Edomites. So we read the phrase this way. Great wrath from Chemosh was on the Israelites, and so the Israelites left. Really? Chemosh beats Yahweh? A prophet of Yahweh says, go fight, and then Chemosh has a human sacrifice, so Chemosh says, I got you. I beat you, Yahweh. Do we really want to believe that? I don't think so. Well, so what's the answer? I've kind of poo-pooed all the answers. In my opinion, the first option I mentioned is the best, that Moab was showing great wrath against Israel. If you're willing to sacrifice the crown prince, the heir to the throne, that shows, boy, these Moabites are really upset. And so the Israelites say, it's not worth fighting anymore. So they left. Why would they leave? Well, they realize now that the Moabites were determined to fight to the very last man, and the Israelites decided it's not worth the cost that it's going to cost us to reduce the city. And besides, siege warfare is difficult to carry out away from home in a desert somewhere. I don't know what kind of siege engines they had back then, but sieges were very, very difficult. And so the Israelites might have been shocked at that child sacrifice, and they might be thinking, you know, the Moabites might do some more of this. They're so determined not to give in. I don't think we ought to continue this fight. After all, it was just a fight over tribute, just money. So we're going to get involved in a war to the death over a fight over money? And so the Israelites left. I think that's the best way to look at it. Moab is showing great wrath against Israel, so much wrath that they're willing to sacrifice the crown prince. The Israelites see this and they think, I don't think this is worth fighting over. And so they go back. And it's interesting, none of my commentators asked the question, well, did the Moabites start paying tribute again? I wonder. They had suffered for not paying the tribute. They had had cities torn down, trees cut down, but they hadn't suffered that much. So it seems to me this military expedition was somewhat of a failure. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with 2 Kings chapter 3. We are now prepared to go to 2 Kings chapter 4. We'll divide chapter 4 into two sections. The first section is verses 1 through 17, where we see Elisha multiplying a jar of widow's oil, and we see him meeting the Shunammite woman, the famous Shunammite woman. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.